Pretend I'm like, in sixth grade and learning this, because when a new reader picks up War and Peace or is reading a history book by a professor like yourself, who's so erudite and knows all the context, you see in War and Peace, they're talking about Austria, then they're talking about it being on the border with Bavaria. What was the difference between those principalities in those days? Were they just like different states of the United States? Different countries like in Europe, we see, or what was the nature of that relationship that we're not able to grasp so easily now?
Yes, because the map has changed so much. And in fact, that's what makes the Napoleonic period so crucial and so interesting, is because that transition from what we can say was medieval Europe, at least in its political side of it, to modern Europe takes place during Napoleonic years. So Germany, as we know it today, didn't exist at this time. So Central Europe, as we know it today, doesn't exist. Instead of a solitary kind of German state, we have a political entity called Holy Roman Empire, which is almost 1,000 years old by this time. So if we count from December 25, 800, when Pope Leo crowned Charlemagne as a Roman emperor, or if you want to kind of change it and speak about Otto being crowned in 962 by Pope John the 12th, in any case, this is a long kind of history of the Holy Roman Empire. That would have been about 800, 900 years old by this time, right? So the empire, to borrow Voltaire's famous expression that it was neither holy nor Roman nor empire, was indeed a very unique political creation, because it is a loose commonwealth of over 300 states, over 300 states. So that means instead of Germany, you have dozens and dozens of bishoprics, free city states, duchies, kingdoms. And over on top of them is the figure of the emperor. Now, emperor was elected. You have some German rulers who are more powerful than the others, that had more say than the others, and therefore they were known as electors. And so this group of nine electors chose the emperor. It happened so that starting in the 16th century forward, the emperors were chosen from the same family, Habsburg family. And therefore, by the time we get to our period, to Napoleonic period, the Holy Roman Empire is in the hands of Habsburgs, who also happen to be the rulers of Austria. So essentially, Austrians are in charge of this. But the problem that the emperors always had is that this is not an empire in the classical sense, where the emperor can do whatever the hell he wants. The emperor always has to deal with the local states, local polities, some more influential than the others. And among the more influential ones was Bavaria, Saxony, Baden, Württemberg, so these kind of mid-sized German states who could not be simply easily browbeaten down into submission. And so that kind of reality where Germany is divided into dozens and dozens and dozens of states, and you have this competition between these different political groups for the dominance, is one of the fundamental themes of German history. But it all comes to an end in 1805. Because Napoleon defeats the Third Coalition at Austerlitz. He's able to take charge of the Central Europe. Holy Roman Empire comes to an end, officially ends in 1806. And then Napoleon then is able to start restructuring these old institutions, old empire, into something new. So instead of 330 plus states, we will now go down to only 39. That's it. Can you imagine how traumatic it is to reduce this proliferation of states, polities, bishoprics, cities, to simply 39 entities that will be part of the Confederation of the Rhine?
So something similar would be like in the United States, if you have kids going into the military after college, like kids from Arkansas meeting kids from Oregon. Over there, they were meeting from these different principalities pursuant to who the emperor was drafting for a needed effort. Like that's how they were meeting.
That's the thing. So imagine if we had 13 colonies, right? And each colony was self-sufficient unit, its own government, its own army, its own troops. If there was an outside threat, and let's say emperor, right, asked, then New York will send troops and fight on behalf of the empire, but only for on specific terms. So the emperor doesn't have a Germanic army that is loyal to him, He's dependent on other states to follow him. And so that becomes one of the crucial elements in this story is the Holy Roman emperors were emperors, but the power that they wielded was always constrained, always limited. And the pushback that they faced from this kind of mid-sized German states was quite pronounced. In fact, other powers oftentimes exploited it. I mean, during 30 Years' War, for example, France exploited it to weaken the empire. And then during the Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon used Bavarians as a way of weakening the empire.
I think it was chapter 13 or 14 around there of your book. You call Kutuzov's retreat, and essentially Tolstoy describes it as going through or from Brunau to Lambach, Amstetten, and then Krems. I saw you labeled it the Glorious Retreat. I didn't find that too many other places. Was that your own name based on what happened,
No,
or
it's not my
from?
so no, the Glorious Retreat is a term that was used back in the 19th century, but especially during Soviet times. And of course I'm using it in a kind of more of an ironic sense, in the quotation marks, because as you pointed out, essentially this is a war that Russians lost, but they found it very hard pill to swallow, right? To admit that they lost it. And so what they almost at the same time, already in early 1806, they're talking about this. Well, we didn't really lose it; it was glorious. There is a famous scene when the army comes back in Moscow. There's an English club, they're very very famous place, and they have enormous festivity to celebrate Bagration, the hero of this campaign, who again he's part of the losing team. But the entire festivity is about how glorious Russians are and how they didn't really lose it. It's those damn Austrians who lost it, but we actually made out unscathed. And so in this narrative, Kutuzov's ability to retreat on time and save the army, so to speak, becomes a victory in its own. So and becomes kind of a glorious accomplishment. And later Soviet historians will use that to trump up this narrative to the height where Kutuzov becomes this kind of genius who outmaneuvers the French. It certainly helps that during this retreat, and you mentioned several important battles like Lambach, Amstetten, right, Krems. So even though French win most of them, Kutuzov does win one crucial one, and that is at Krems, where he routs one of the French corps. Now, French claim that as their own victory too, for example, because only essentially, a division, French division, was attacked by the Russian army and routed, but it held its ground. Russians claimed it as a victory because they were able to capture prisoners, hold the ground, and so on. But from so in this narrative that you can create about glorious retreat, you can focus on events like at Krems, and you say, "Hey, see, when we were fighting alone without Austrians, we were winning. It's those Austrian traitors who sabotaged our war."
So when he's retreating with this large group, it's the fall of 1805. In these battles, what did they consider to be winning and losing in terms of at Ulm? Somehow Napoleon did this, what's regarded as a masterful encircling maneuver, and then General Mack had to surrender 20,000 to 30,000 soldiers. First of all, what do all those soldiers do after they surrender? Do they just give up their arms and walk home? And that's is the difference that Kutuzov soldiers never got involved in encircles and had to surrender, and that's why that retreat might have been somewhat glorious.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, the fundamental problem that Austrians, led by General Mack, faced was the fact that they were outsmarted, outmarched, outmaneuvered, and they find themselves in a pocket, surrounded and forced to surrender. So there was no way for them to escape. Part of them escaped. I do want to point out that one part of them managed to fight out and escape, but most of them didn't, and they had to surrender. The surrendered troops were usually taken under control, disarmed, taken to the camps, and then most cases sent home on the parole. In some cases, they would be kept in captivity, but officers usually were sent back home on the parole, so they would give their honest word that they will not fight, and that was kind of taken for granted that they will not break the parole. For Kutuzov, of course, the fact that he listened to his gut. And when he's at Braunau and the Austrians are telling him, "You got to march to Ulm, got to march to Ulm," He listens to himself and says, no, I'm not going to march until I know for sure that the things at Ulm are safe. And that essentially saves the army. He makes the correct choice and turns the army and marches back before Napoleon could bring most of his army to attack him. And so that those 2 3 days, a start that Kutuzov has, are crucial. It allows him to retreat through the valley of the Danube River. And then once the French do catch up to him, it's hard to fight against an opponent who is well trained, well organized, well led. So even the battles at Lambach, Amstetten, later on at Hollabrunn, these are bloody battles where Russians clearly show that they are very good, very strong opponents. I mean, at Hollabrunn in November of 1805, we see Bagration with barely 7,000 men fighting against twice, if you listen to Russian sources, 5 times bigger French army, and holding its ground and saving the rest of the the rest of the army. So French knew and they respected the Russian soldier. They respected the character traits of the Russian soldiers. And Napoleon famously says it's not enough to simply kill Russian soldier. You also have to push him over because even dead, they stand and hold ground. And that clearly is on the show in 1805, and then again in 1806, 1807, most famously in 1812.
One thing which I think Tolstoy really brought out, and was just a detail, and you referenced it in your book, it just touches on the human element of people living during these times. There's a scene where Andrei Bolkonski was being yelled at by a carriage driver. The guy was drunk, and he was whipping another carriage driver who had a woman with him, and it was a physician and his wife. And I noticed in your book, you said, in Kutuzov's army, sometimes I guess the upper echelon soldiers, some of them were allowed to take their wives with them, or they happened to meet in the same cities, and that was not technically allowed, but it was practiced. And I found that fascinating. Was that, did that happen
Oh
in
yes,
all of the armies,
absolutely.
or just in the, for
Absolutely.
the czars?
I think so. In general, and not surprisingly, armies don't want non-military personnel accompanying, right? Time and again, you would see the officers, generals, kind of telling their subordinates, "Please leave your wives behind." But the reality is that it's, the orders were not followed oftentimes. And I think in the book I describe at the beginning of this 1805 campaign, it's a fascinating kind of scene where the Russian officers were convinced that this will be a jolly old stroll, kind of will defeat the Napoleon. So it will be a nice, leisurely stroll to the west through the Bohemia and Moravia. And so a lot of officers brought their wives with them. But the regulations prohibited presence of their wives. And so before Kutuzov arrives, he issues an order saying, "Hey, by the way, leave the wives behind." And the officers didn't listen to that. And so in August, there's a military parade. And one of my favorite guys from this entire period is Major General Gregor von Berg. He's of German extraction, but he's a Russian general. He's commanding Malorossiysky Grenadier Regiment. And so he describes this fascinating scene where the military parade takes place. These units are marching, all kind of spec, kind of all squeakily clean and beautifully to look at. And then right at the end of it, and as their units march, show up wives in carriages, and they kind of follow it. And so the commanding general, Ferdinand Wintzingerode, he like, "What the hell is this?" And so he turns around. And he asks his generals, "I thought it has been prohibited for officers to take women with them." And Berg, kind of realizing that they all got caught, Berg's wife is there too. And so he said, "Oh, yes, it is prohibited, but these wives are not coming with us. They just happen to be traveling in the same direction."
I have a last topic, and I sort of get this from reading. I believe he's the chair of Harvard of Ukrainian Studies, Sergei Polhy. He speaks
A
about
great historian with a great book. I highly recommend his The Gates of Europe, which is a history of Ukraine. Yeah.
I read The Gates of Europe, The Cossack Myth,
Yeah.
which had some of the Cossacks going into France at the end of this whole
That's
tale
right. That's
and
right.
being noticed by the Parisians and them getting a kick out of them.
Yes.
Now, one of the thing was the rivalries, and like you hear about at the end when Napoleon's army lost its morale and they're being subjected to raids by a number of Cossacks. And tell me your understanding, but from reading his book and my own history, as you can see, my last name is Ukrainian. I get the sense that Cossacks were people who lived on the borders of empires, whether it was Muscovy, Polish, Lithuania, Turkish. They could generally be all ethnicities and come together, but they developed something. It's part of Ukrainian identity. So my question is, perhaps some people from Galicia and Poland fought with Napoleon, but was there ever a chance for Napoleon's forces to get Cossacks who believed they were being oppressed and the Tsar wasn't living up to their obligations to side against Muscovy and the Tsar? And was there a missed opportunity there?
Yes, and I would say more broadly, maybe I will address two issues here. One is that oftentimes we have a confusion of Ukrainian Cossacks with the, for example, Don Cossacks.
Yes.
Many of the Cossacks who are serving in the Russian army are not necessarily Ukrainian Cossacks, as the Zaporozhian Sich are Cossack, but rather these are the militarized settlements that Catherine established in the Don region in North Caucasus and elsewhere, whose goal it was to provide soldiers for the empire. And those Cossacks are, again, not necessarily Ukrainians, but rather kind of a very imperial mindset, because they are settlers in the borderlands of the empire, and they deal with, for example, Circassians. They deal with the North Caucasian mountaineers that. And this is they perceive themselves as an outpost of the empire. So that's one. The second is that many of those Cossacks as were not actually ethnically Russian, Ukrainian, not even ethnically Slavic. In the Western imagination, Cossacks were kind of broad term that was used towards other nomadic tribes that were recruited by the empire to fight against Napoleon. So you see, for example, there are Bashkirs, there are Kalmyks, there are Kazakh, right? All of them kind of were oftentimes grouped together. As for your other side, question, is that absolutely, I think that's one of the missed opportunities Napoleon has. When he crosses the Niemen River in June of 1812 and arrives in Vilnius, he's greeted there with widespread acclaim, jubilation by the local Polish-Lithuanian elite. Same can be said when the French troops are marching through what is Belarus today, what is northern Ukraine. A lot of those communities welcome French because these are the regions that the Russian Empire acquired forcefully through the partitions of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth barely 20 years earlier, right? The last partition is finalized in 1795. In fact, the formal agreement is done in 1797. So 15 years later, Napoleon shows up. The memories of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the memories of a different way of life is still fresh. And so one of the unanswered questions is what would have happened if Napoleon tapped those memories, tapped those sentiments, and let's say proclaimed the restoration of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth? How would have the local population react? Would the mass of Ukrainian peasantry, Lithuanian peasantry, responded to that? Because we do know that the elites would have been more receptive to it.
Very interesting. Well, I think we've covered a lot. I had a great time talking to you. I think it was very enlightening. It's such an era that's lost, but people know War and Peace. It's always going to be on your top five books. So this era, whether it gets details wrong or not, it seems like Tolstoy has touched on something transcendent, I guess, in terms of the work and character he's created. And there was a I think from Stanford, there was someone who, like yourself, I guess in the 60s or 70s, they wrote a book, The Genesis of War and Peace, and got to go to look at the family archives and, speaks about that was during the Soviet times. And it gives a background on him putting together the characters. And the section we're speaking to right now was like an add-in. So it went, because it's like such an interesting story. You learn the characters, all their dynamics. The father's dying. He's a rich guy. He has all these serfs. And then it goes into kind of like your book, and you're reading about history for a modern reader. That might not be that exciting. And then you're
Yeah.
back into the characters and the
Okay.
inheritance, and this one marries that. So
Yeah.
whether accurate or not, he's touched on something where for generations, people are always going to be brought back to this era because it's a novel that somehow stands apart.
Absolutely. I mean, that's I mean, it's an epic point, an epic work of literature that in many ways transcends the literary confines. I mean, there's a lot of philosophy that Tolstoy incorporates here that makes it relevant to us. I was just at the conference where we were discussing Tolstoy's visions of history and the role of individual in history. Because, you know, if there's one clear theme through War and Peace is this juxtaposition of Napoleon as a man of action who wants to control his own fate, and Kutuzov as the more passive, more docile individual who understand that there are kind of larger historical forces that he can't control. And that in itself is a fascinating thread to unravel as you read War and Peace and you see where Tolstoy's personal allegiances lay. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the history, discuss the personalities, and I hope your listeners will reach out to me, and if they have any questions, I'll be happy to address them.
Wonderful. I hope to reach out to you again at another point. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, and I hope we keep in touch.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.